steps. In fact, there's one good experimental setup, which is the setup we have at NIST. There's another setup in Europe at the Langevin Institute, and there's a setup in Japan. But neither of the ones outside of NIST have the precision of the system that we have there. So it's difficult to do experiments. And as perhaps you saw in the discussions that continued last night, at least I hope they did, if you're looking at quantum information ideas, most of those ideas have been looked at, and because we have limited contrast, there's a limit to what we really want to conclude from those. So the driving force today isn't really to do quantum information processing. The driving force is to use quantum information processing to make interferometers that are useful for either standard model physics, so for instance, search for the neutron electric dipole moment, or to use neutrons as probes of magnetism or material science. And so it's still pieces of quantum information theory, but with an application not to building information processors, but to building devices. And so the system I'm going to talk about today is a nitrogen vacancy in diamond. It is an area where many people are working today. This is a very, very dynamic field. If you listen to people coming in and giving job talks to move into physics, experimental condensed matter people, many of them are suggesting moving into this field. Three of my ex-students have just gotten jobs at universities, all of them planning on doing experiments in this field. And so there's a wealth of interest. We'll see how it can be maintained. But this is, you know, exactly the opposite picture. Here we're taking a system that is really under current exploration. And, okay, you have diamond. So diamond is of course, a diamond lattice in a solid-state system. So I can try to draw the diamond lattice for you. I can try. Okay, continues like this. Etc. And what happens in the diamond lattice? Of course, all of these interfaces are carbons in the diamond lattice. And what happens is exactly as described, that at one point there's a substitution of nitrogen for carbon. And then associated with that, there are many possible defects in diamond. But the one we're interested in is where there's an adjacent vacancy. So if you implant nitrogen and then you anneal your diamond, you will get this nice defect, which has a nitrogen in a vacancy. And when you look at this spectroscopically, what you find is that there's a stable electron there. So there's an electron that's sitting here. In fact, if you're careful about it, there are six electrons that you need to worry about. But that's a little bit too much detail for us here. And if the two of the electrons couple very strongly and they form a spin one system. And that's the control element that we're going to use in this system. So here what we're going to do is we'll first use a spin one electron that's sitting here. Okay, now so electrons are spin one half. This is a composite electron that looks like a spin one. And then, of course, the nitrogen has spin. So if it's nitrogen 15, it has spin 1/2. If it's nitrogen 14, it has spin 1. And nitrogen 14 is much more common than nitrogen 15. So we can think that there's nitrogen 14 here. And then somewhere in this, there'll be a C13. This is C13, you know, most carbon is C12. But C13 is 1% naturally abundant. So if I look at a typical diamond sample, then of course I don't have to go far to find a C13. And so we're going to use the C13 as well. And then there's going to be an electronic excited state that we're going to use as well. So we need to look at all of that physics to understand what this is. And it's modeled often as saying, this is just looks like a trapped ion, as though Dave Weinland was doing trapped ions stored in a, individual ions stored in a pinning trap or others. In truth, there's a lot more physics here than there is in the trapped ion world. Yeah, well, it would be, in this case, it's an electron. We only care about the electron. But we think about it as an ion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a great question. The original way it was done was to notice that there are these blue diamonds that one sees occasionally. And if you look at the blue diamonds, they have exactly this defect. And it gives a very nice spectroscopy. Okay, so they were found initially naturally, and of course, there would be many sites, and so we would scan through the diamond until we found the one that we wanted and that had a C13 that was close enough to be of interest. Now what we do today is, of course, it's very easy today to make high-quality synthetic diamonds. And so today what we do is we grow a synthetic diamond. When you grow a synthetic diamond, even if you try not to have defects, you have a few defects. And so we can find these in the highest quality grown diamond without doing anything. But sometimes we would like to have a few more, and so we do ion implantation of nitrogen. So we just take a nitrogen gas, and we provide some momentum to it, and we implant it into the surface of the diamond. That's right. I mean, remember that 1% of the spin are carbon 13, and so the first shell has six carbons. The second shell has 36. It doesn't expand quite that way, but as you go out and out, you don't have to go very far to find 100 carbons. And so the probability that one of those is a C13 is pretty high. No. What happens is the nitrogen can migrate through the crystal, and it migrates until it finds a vacancy. And then it sits there. Okay. So once you form this complex, that is in fact a very stable complex. And so that's why there are so many possible defects in diamond. That once we've made a sample, we heat it up, so anneal it, that they find, and then after that it's stable. So when we look at an individual center, it's going to stay like that for months. So we can if our experimental setup is robust enough, we can study one particular electron per month. Okay. So the first thing I want to do is to look at the physics briefly of how we ended up with the spin one. So we have a Hamiltonian that is going to look like omega naught. So we'll take two spin 1/2 particles, and again, we'll just put some energy, we'll quantize the system along some axis. It's important that the energy is not exactly the same. So the idea here is that omega naught is much, much bigger than delta omega. Effectively, we're going to go into an interaction frame with omega naught. I'm just going to suppress omega naught, although it's the biggest term, and we'll look at what happens with delta omega. Yes? So in this case, I'm just assuming a Hamiltonian because I want to look at a particular piece of physics. When I come over here and come back to the NV center, then we'll talk very explicitly about where the Hamiltonian comes from. And it's actually an incredibly difficult question of experimentally proving that you know all the terms in the Hamiltonian. So that's an active area of research. And we don't even know the efficiency with which one can do that. It's a good question, but I'll come back to it. But right now I'm just inventing one to prove a point. Okay, so I have two spin 1/2 particles. They have slightly different energies, and there's a coupling term that connects them. And it'll be easy for you to show. You could do it. That sigma dot sigma commutes with the sum of sigma z, sigma z. So I need this term. I want to have some non-commutivity in the problem. Okay. So now let's take this term and expand it. So of course, sigma dot sigma, we can rewrite in terms of its element. And to have the most revealing structure, we'll take this piece and rewrite it in terms of raising and lowering operators in the z basis. So you'll remember that sigma plus minus is equal to sigma x plus minus sigma y. So here we can rewrite. That term. And of course, what this piece does is it allows us to have two spins that are anti-aligned flipped. Okay? So if I wrote down the energy level diagram, then this term connects those two states, right? And that's normally not an allowed transition. Normally we think of an allowed transition as being a dipole allowed transition to flip one state. But here, that term connects those two states. Yes? So J is less than omega naught. Omega naught, much, much greater than delta omega or J. Okay. There's two spins. I don't care. Okay? If been influenced too much by some other quest. Okay. So now, let's go back to this term. We said that if the delta omega term is zero, that these terms commute, those terms commute, meaning that they simultaneously define the energy in the system. It makes a lot of sense. If I have, I don't have a term here, then these two energies, when I flip them, it doesn't cost any energy, right? And so yes, this is allowed. But as I add this term, of course, now it costs energy. And therefore, of course, the commutator of sigma x plus sigma y with sigma z minus sigma z is not good. Yeah? Now then, we want to know what happens as we vary delta omega in J. And of course, what's going to happen, and let me redraw this to make it a little bit easier for me. What's going to happen is that these two states are going to mix. And we'll get two new states out. And of course, we can see that by writing out the Hamiltonian in the Z basis. And let me see if I can get this right. Okay, along the diagonal, all we have, okay, so is these two terms and this sigma z piece. And then off the diagonal, all we're connecting are these two terms that connect those levels, and it's j over 2. Okay, and the rest of the terms are the rest of the Hamiltonian. Is zero. So if we say, well, what is the eigenstructure of the Hamiltonian? You would say, hey, looks like two of the states aren't going to mix. We only need to worry about the mixing of those two states. And let me save myself writing down some stuff here. So if I,
the H that you wrote down is
H.
Script H.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's the Hamiltonian. It's just a Hamiltonian in written out in matrix form for that. So now if I look at the eigenvectors for this system, then of course the eigenvectors are two of the original states and a simple mixing of the other two states. And the amount that we mix them is the arc 10 of J divided by D, which is the difference in frequency, just as you would expect there. Okay? And so now we have four energy levels. And of course, if we wanted to know the dipolar allowed selection rules, remember that on this case, the allowed transitions are, we have this transition is allowed, that one is allowed, this one, and that one, right? Those are the four allowed transitions here. And now then, If we look at the allowed transitions, then what we'll see is that we should look at Fermi's golden rule with the operator corresponding to a spin flip. So in that case, the operator that we're looking at is sigma xA plus sigma xB. Yeah? Good. All right. The rest of this you can look at yourself. I actually do calculate for you the spectra that you see. So let's just look at an example of that. So this is the energy axis, and this is the spectrum of that, saying, effectively, what is the probability that you're allowed to have a transition, right, versus the energy? And what do we have? We have a separation of energy. It's delta omega. Of course, there's some absolute energy, but who cares? And then there's a coupling, J. So that if I looked at it in this basis, I would say, well, okay, this is the up-up, up-down, down-down, and down-up states, right? And we could assign this. And as delta omega and J come closer and closer to each other, then we no longer have that same picture. In fact, you know, just to say that if delta omega was infinite, right, then the amplitudes would all be the same, right?
So
yeah.
There's four spikes in this picture.
Four beautiful resonances.
Four transitions.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go down to here. I don't know. Which one do you want to look at? Probably neither. You have to look at one. We'll look at this. Nah. Let's look up here first, and I'll come back to that. As I make the difference in frequency smaller, okay, then the asymmetry and the amplitudes of the peak become larger. When the differences in frequencies become very small, then what happens is the outer peaks shift further and further away, okay, and they become not allowed, right? And the central two lines come closer and closer, and they will coalesce. And at the point where we have full mixing, we end up with one manifold that has three transitions, but the difference in energies here are exactly the same. They're both omega naught. And then there's the asymmetric state, which is sitting out here, right? And so this is familiar to you as a triplet and a singlet. And there are no transitions that are allowed between here. Yeah?
So I don't understand that the small peaks on yeah. the very end. I can't really see very small transitions.
So this is what happens when theta is equal to 90 degrees, right? And then we see that we have allowed transitions here, but there are two at the same energy. And these transitions are not allowed. These are forbidden. It's pretty easy to see. Take sigma x plus sigma x. Remember that the operator that we're going to put into Fermi's golden rule has to be the symmetric operator, because we're saying that we can't distinguish between those two spins. So I'm not allowed to put anything here but a symmetric combination of two sigma x's. And because of the sign, there's an interference effect that doesn't, that takes the Fermi probability to zero. Okay, so if I had just, if I was flipping just one spin, this would be an allowed transition. But because I'm flipping both the spins, that's a forbidden transition. Yeah? So go through that, have a look. And so what happens here is that this is not quite at that triplet level. And so the outer transitions are suppressed, but they're in they're really quite suppressed. But they're not zero, right? And the inner transitions haven't quite coalesced into one log. Any other question?
Could you clarify what exactly is this part?
So here on this axis is the eigenenergy. Okay, so that's the, it's the difference in eigenenergies. This is the transition energy. So if I look at having a transition between here and here, which have a different color chalk, then I associate an energy with that. And that's what I'm plotting on the horizontal axis. And on the vertical axis is the probability that the transition occurs. Okay? And we just calculate that by Fermi's golden rule. And then this is exactly what one would see as a spectra if I took this system, I prepared some initial state, and I perturbed it, and then I used this as a measurement operator, I would see exactly the same thing. There's a perfect correspondence between those two pictures. You still had a question. I'm sorry. You're worrying about the finite width of these.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thanks for that question. The finite width because it came because I actually did put decoherence into the model, and so yes, I didn't say that. I should. If you go up to the top of the file, you'll see that there's decoherence in there. Otherwise, it would be a delta function as you've suggested. Okay, so now let's try to look at this plot. In this plot, what I'm doing is varying the coupling strength. So I start off with here, with a finite separation between the two resonances and a coupling strength. Right, so we have delta omega and the coupling strength. And then I'm going to leave the coupling strength the same. I'm just going to change delta omega, okay? And to try to make it clear, though maybe I've failed miserably at that, I shift the spectra over each time, okay, just so that they don't appear on top of each other. So as you go through this, what happens is that delta omega is getting smaller, so you can see that we get closer and closer to one peak, and the small peaks shift out, yeah, and they go out further and further, and the further and further they go out, they become smaller and smaller, yeah? And just to say, I'm going to go back up to the other picture. Here, this is the same picture, but I didn't shift them over, right? So you see two peaks, and they come closer and closer to one peak, and these satellite peaks go out and out and out. And any idea why they come back in like this? It's nothing to do with physics. It's just aliasing. So you end up calculating this by Fourier transform. These should be going out like this, but they're aliased in. And if that doesn't, does that mean anything to people? How many people know the Nyquist condition? No one. All right. We put it over here. I'll come back to that in the last 5 minutes. Okay. The rest of it, you can read. It doesn't matter. Here, what does matter is at this point, we end up having what looks like a spin 1 system and plus a spin 0 system, and there's no allowed transitions between them. Okay? And so we have these two manifolds, and it's a spin 1 manifold that we're going to use over here. Okay, so in this case, we have exactly the same thing. We have two electron spins, and they have this coupling. Physically, what does that coupling mean? It means that there are two sites that these electrons can occupy, and they exchange. So you're not allowed to say that the red electron is in one site and the blue electron is in the other. There's an exchange interaction, and that exchange interaction is very fast. Okay. Good. Now then, we look at the NB system, and we want to look at the Hamiltonian here. The first element of the Hamiltonian is exactly this exchange coupling. In this picture, it was convenient for me to put in this Strong-Zamon interaction so I could define an energy basis. I could define eigenstates. In the NV system, the Zamon interaction is small. The very first interaction we have is the exchange interaction. And we're looking at the exchange interaction in this manifold. Right? So forget all of this, and this is the only term that we have. So in the exchange interaction of that manifold, we end up with an energy level structure that looks like this. These are degenerate. And the term in the Hamiltonian is the so-called zero field splitting, which comes in as sigma z squared. Okay, so now then I have a splitting here, and it's a zero field, and it's 3 gigahertz. Okay, so that's the first term we have. And again, the reason it has this structure is we don't have the Zamon interaction yet. Okay? Now, when we look at a physical system, it's important that we not only define the frequency, we need to define a direction. So I said, oh, it's z. But that z has an orientation in the molecule. And so z is along that bond. That's the z direction. Okay? Yeah, that's going to be important. Yeah, Jeeva. Okay,
so we don't have the Zeeman
right
term, and that's why those two levels, MS equals plus or minus 1, are almost degenerate. So
they're absolutely degenerate.
But why is the MS 0 then less than those systems? Because the exchange coupling?
Yes, that's right. Okay, so the next thing we're going to do is we're going to add a Zeeman interaction. So now then the Hamiltonian has a term that looks like gamma B0 of sigma Z prime, where this Z corresponds to the direction of the applied magnetic field. So somewhere here we have a magnetic field direction, and there's an angle between those two, theta. Okay. Now you can see that if I looked at the NV center, there are lots of directions the NV center can have. In fact, there are 6 different directions it can have. So I can't align the diamond crystal and say, I know what that axis is. I know it has one of those 6 values. And so when we apply the magnetic field, we can't automatically or trivially put the magnetic field along the axis of the defect. And so there's a separation here. So we need to rewrite this as omega z, which is just gamma b naught, cosine theta sigma z plus sine theta sigma x. Both of these interactions are cylindrically symmetric, so I only have to define one angle for this. Okay, so we have a principal axis system here, principal axis system, and this is defined by the molecule. And this one is defined by the applied field. Now this seems like we're dead, because if this one can take six different values, and then I try to do an experiment with this, then if I looked at the signal from it, I would see six different results that had no relationship to each other. It would be a drag. And so what we want to do is we want to have a setup. We want an experimental setup that allows us to see one electron. And we do that by an optical transition. So here's the Hamiltonian that we have. So we have an electron excitation. And the electron excitation is at 532 nanometers. So there, that transition is 532 nanometers. Okay, so you can see that transition. Here, probably you know nothing about symmetries of electronic excitations. Of course, you all know the hydrogen atoms, so you should, but forget it. They're just labels. Okay, I have a manifold here and a manifold there. Okay? Here we have MS equals zero, plus and minus 1, plus and minus 1, 0. And remember that this separation is 3 gigahertz. This separation is, 10 to the 12 hertz. So, you know, big, big, big separation in energy between those two. So that's not the problem. And we're going to look at the system from a photon point of view. You know, this is just a photon. So I want to see that photon. So experimentally, that is 637 nanometers. Probably doesn't matter that much to you. But I might as well get it right. I take 532 nanometer laser. Okay, so let me explain. We have a 532 nanometer laser. I send it through something called an acoustic optical modulator, which is just a fancy, very fast, and very, very clean switch. So I can turn the laser on and off. I can't turn the laser itself on and off, but these are our fibers. So I'm putting the laser into fiber, and I can certainly turn the light intensity off. This is a dichromatic laser, dichromatic lens. Jeez, I'll try it one more time. It's actually a dichromatic mirror. And what it does is it allows 532 to go through, and it reflects 637. Over here, we have an avalanche diode, which is can see one photon on average. So here we have single photon sensitivity. Down here, I have a microscope. And then the diamond sample. And what I'm going to do with the microscope is we're going to illuminate a very small spot. We're going to make as small a spot as possible. And we're going to put it to the focal plane in the diamond. And then I'm going to use piezos to raster the diamond back and forth. And we're going to look for fluorescence. And I think I have an example. Yeah. So if I look over here, we're scanning through the diamond. And you can see that we're scanning over about 40 squared microns in one particular plane. So confocal is a spot size in three dimensions, and we can see a number of centers. Okay, they won't all be this particular defect, but they're about that sparse, and so we can sit on one of these, and we can study the spin physics of that. Okay.
Why are two of those so much brighter than the other ones?
Because they're closer to being in the right plane. So we're looking at one particular plane, and these are above or below the plane that we want. Okay. Of course, the other answer is that this one is very nonlinear. If you look at the differences aren't as big, but still, that is the reason that we have those. Yes, please.
So I have a question about your setup. So
yeah.
You actually need the 637 meter, right?
Yeah.
Why does it go to the single photon detector?
So here I want to observe this piece, right? And there's an idea that's used frequently, called the cycling transition. And let me just show it figuratively here for two levels. And then we're going to expand it to that idea. So I hope this will answer your question. So imagine that we have just a spin 1/2. And it's separated by an electron transition. Well, the electron transition can't flip the spin. So what's happening is that if we excite up to here, so we can pump it with a laser, it will fall back down. And it falls back down and emits a photon. And so a nice way of doing detection is if this transition and this transition have different energies. So this is energy up and energy down. If those two have different energies, then I can just sit here, pump this one, keep getting photons out, and I get lots and lots of photons because I just keep returning the system back to its original state. And so we get a bucket of photons, and we can have a really high sensitivity for differentiating those two. Okay? And we're going to do something that's not quite the same here. What we're going to do is we're going to excite anywhere in this manifold, and we're going to excite it way up here. Okay, that's what the 532 does. It excites us way above the energy level diagram that we have. And we don't have a clue about what happens up there. There's lots of papers, but they don't have a clue. They just publish papers. And the system falls down, and it falls down to this state, and it sits here. Okay? And the nice promise is that the spin degree of freedom is really separate from all of those things. So if we start off in the zero state, we fall down to the zero state. If we start off in the one plus or minus one states, we end up in the plus or minus one states. And then these states will decay. And the lifetime of those states, and when they decay, they give off a photon. And whether it's the zero state or the plus or minus one states, the difference in photon energy, there is a difference, but it's very small, and our experimental apparatus doesn't distinguish it. Okay, so they're all collected. And the decay time is 30 nanoseconds. With that piece of physics, I can't tell you what the electron spin state is. Right, there isn't enough. But look over here. When we went to this system, we were left with that singlet state sitting out there by its lonesome. And one of the rules about solid state physics is that nothing's ever really forbidden. Okay? The theory looks nice, you can work it out, it'll say that it's forbidden. But the reason it'll say it's forbidden is you haven't included enough of what's going on in the lattice. There's no transition that's ever really forbidden. So sitting out over here is the singlet state, which you can get to only from the plus and minus one states. And one third of the time, with probability one third, if you're here, you end up there. And from this state, you can only relax back down to zero. And, very nice, it has a lifetime of 300 nanoseconds. Okay, so now let's see what happens. Let's say I was in the zero state, and we applied this 532. Well, we'd end up back in the zero state here. And then within 30 nanoseconds on average, we would get back down to zero state. And we would go back up again. We just keep the laser on, and we keep getting light out at this frequency. Okay, so we get a lot of light out. And the nice thing about having this frequency and this frequency different is I can detect with the laser on. Okay, life is good. So we can just keep cycling through this, and I get a lot of photons. So if I look at the photon intensity, as a function of time, if I'm in the zero state, we just keep getting photons. Now let's say that we're in the plus or minus one state. If we're in the plus or minus one state, we go up, we end up in the plus or minus one state. And two-thirds of the time, it comes down and gets an intensity. But one-third of the time, it comes over here to this, which is this physics is called an intersystem crossing. We end up over here. And for 300 nanoseconds, you know, this is a really long time, 300 nanoseconds, it can't emit a photon. And it sits there. Okay, so what happens is if I was in the plus and minus one state, the intensity is a bit less. And if I look at it for a short time, it falls a little bit. But then notice what happens. We end up in the zero state again, right? If I end up in the zero state, we get back to that. Okay? So if I want to distinguish whether I was in the plus minus one state or the zero state, if I count for a short period of time, then I have some contrast. And I can say with some probability I was in, you know, this manifold or that manifold. Okay, so that's our detection method. You can also see that this is a nice way of preparing the system. That if I just turn the laser on for a long time, I know that I'm going to end up in the zero state. Right, so to end up in the electronic zero state, I just turn the laser on and wait, and we'll end up right here. Okay, so good preparation. Now, of course, you have your defect sitting in the diamond. The defect is going to give off a photon. That defect is giving off a photon as though it was a point source. So it gives off a photon in all possible directions. And we have this lovely optics that is designed exclusively to have a small spot size. So our probability of detecting a photon that comes from this is really, really low. So we get very few of those photons. But of course, we can cycle through this many times. But it's a funny, it's pretty common to have this arrangement. It's a funny experiment because we say we have a single photon detector. Here we're saying we're looking at a single quantum system. We say that we have single shot measurement. Actually, I don't say that, but you'll find it in other people's papers. But we have to average a million experiments to get enough statistics to have a contrast curve. And the reason we have to average so many experiments is, one would like an expectation value, right? So you better average something. Two, you're going to have a low visibility of the photons actually reaching your detector. And so if we were going to describe this in terms of what the measurement looks like, right, then I would say, well, I have an operator for the measurement that looks like the identity where the operator looks like this. That mostly we can't tell what happens, but there's a probability that we would know if we were in a zero state, right? And then the second operator, of course, has to look this. We have a set of measurement operators we require of them that that they correspond to all possible outcomes, and so I need this one as well. Yeah?
Which one is a qubit?
So at the moment, we haven't defined it. We've just said here's the Hilbert space, right? What we will do is we'll split the energy levels between the plus and minus one state, and then we'll choose one of those transitions, say 0 to minus 1, to be a qubit, right? I don't want to choose plus 1 to minus 1 to be a qubit, at least trivially, because I can't separate the two. Yeah. Yes, please.
This diagram is for total angular momentum 1 plus
spin 1, right? So here we say we have spin 1. Yeah, here we have spin 1. And this is a little bit of a spin 0 piece stuck on. Yeah, right. And that's because we have this term here, right? So in looking at the physics here, I included the Zeeman interaction. And the reason for doing that is then I can label the states, right? We can associate, if I have spin 0, then I say, oh, yeah, what's a good quantum number? The good quantum number is the sum of sigma z, okay? If I just took, I could have done that. If I just throw away all of this and said, what are the eigenvectors of this term, right? Then we would see that sigma z squared is a good quantum number. And then we would have to worry about having this degeneracy in the system. Okay? But that's the difference. Here, we have this. And this is also the exact analysis we need next week for magnetic resonance. So we'll keep using this. Okay, but the difference is here we've defined an energy that is defined by the sum of the z components of the spin angular momentum. Here we've said that the energy of the system is the quantization axis is given by the zero field splitting. Okay, so we end up with the same eigenvectors, but with a different spectrum. Yeah. Yeah, please.
So what you're putting zero field splitting omega here, that it's j omega.
That's right.
And
yeah.
We don't have a delta omega.
No, absolutely not. That's in this system up to here, there's no delta omega. Here there's a delta omega, right? You know, here we say that there's a Zeeman splitting. Yeah. Here we have a Zeeman splitting. Let me not say it's a delta omega. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to need... I thought I would, again, get a little further. Sorry about that. Let me save that because it's too nice a piece of physics to cover so quickly that you won't understand it. So let me just finish by putting a couple more terms on the Hamiltonian, and then we'll use them tomorrow. So far what we've done is to say that we have an exchange interaction with a Zeeman interaction. Now notice the nice thing. Because we have this confocal setup, so this piece here is called a confocal microscope. Because we have the confocal microscope, we can see one photon. We can see one center, and life is good. I know that in that picture I showed of the image of the diamond defects, that we only have one. Okay? And how many of you guys know the Hongo-Mandel effect? None. Okay. We have that. I'll talk about that next class because we, again, won't have time this class. But the Hongo-Mandel effect is a way optically of telling that you have only one source of photons in your experiment, and you can do that precisely. We'll define that. But now then, we have the Zeeman interaction. I want to add a spin. We said, hey, we have this C13 sitting over here. And there are two ways that we couple to that C13. One way is through space, that the C13 is a magnetic dipole. And we have the electrons that are spin one electron. And so the first coupling is a through space dipolar coupling and it has a Hamiltonian that looks like that form, that has this form. The second piece is that there's a Fermi contact term. And the Fermi contact term says that the electron wave function overlaps the nuclear spin. Right? So if the electron wave function includes S character at the nucleus we're interested in, then the wave function will overlap the nuclear spin. And there'll be a direct interaction between the electron and nuclear spin, not through space, right? It's a contact term. And there, the Hamiltonian for the Fermi contact is equal to some frequency sigma electron dot sigma nuclear. It's an isotropic term. Okay, so we have these two terms. They're both part, they both contribute to what's called a hyperfine coupling. And they are by far the biggest terms that we see in the nuclear manifold. Now, remember yesterday when we went to this interaction frame and we looked at the Magnus expansion and we looked at the first order correction to the Magnus expansion. And what we saw in that first order correction was that the non-commutivity of time-dependent terms can lead to a new interaction in the system. What happens here is, here's my electron spin S. Now I add two nuclear levels. The nuclear in C13 is either spin up or spin down. So this is nuclear. Now the hyperfine term, you're going to say, well, that should be zero in the MS equals zero manifold, right? Because the hyperfine is always going to come proportional to the strength of the electron magnetic moment. And the electron magnetic moment is zero in the MS equals zero manifold. So when we think that there's no physics here, but if I look in second order in perturbation theory, or if I look in first order in the Magnus expansion that I showed you, then there'll be a commutator that looks like SX, IX, SX, IY. Okay? Just expand these terms out. And remember that we have this bloody piece here, right? So Z is not Z anymore. We have to split it between Z and X. So I'll get this term, and this is going to be proportional to IZ. And so what will happen is we'll have, in fact, a big apparent field. So the nuclear spin sitting even in the MS equals zero manifold is going to observe that it has a large, that it's sitting in a large magnetic field. That large magnetic field, of course, is associated with the electron spin, but it's only a second order effect of the electron spin. And so the resonance frequency here is going to be megahertz, where in the absence of the hyperfine interaction, it would be a few hertz. So we get an enhancement of about 10 to the 6 in terms of the apparent resonance frequency of the nuclear spin. So even we can control the nuclear spins. Okay, so I'll describe that in a little bit more detail tomorrow, and we'll go through a little bit of the physics. Okay, and then Tibra, send me an email reminding me of those two, and then I'll look at that. Okay. Before we close here, if I threw away the last thing on the nuclear spins, do people get the rest of this picture? Yeah? Okay. At this moment, you don't have to understand the nuclear spins, but there's something that you don't know about the rest of it. Let's talk.